In 1967, in the Six-Day War, Israel miraculously liberated Judea, Samaria, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, all parts of historical Israel, and all territories that are vital for Israel's security. Now, since 1967, though, there's been a tremendous debate about whether or not Israel should give those lands away. And even today, in early 2024, there are many who are opining that Israel should give the lands away. And it's not only been a discussion in the international community whether or not Israel should give these lands to the Arabs, to the so-called Palestinians to establish a Palestinian state, but it's also been a dispute amongst Jews, and in particular, even amongst some rabbis. It happens to be that since the Intifada in 2000, between 2000 and 2005, the second Intifada, the support for giving away land putatively for peace has very much gone down. But that wasn't always the case. In this year, we're going to explore a chapter in history, an exchange between the Lubavitch Rebbe and Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz, who was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. In an article published in October, Chief Rabbi Jacobowitz linked Lubavitch, Meir Kahana, and Gush Emunim as extremists. Now, he had done so because all three of these groups, Chabad, as in the Lubavitch Rebbe and his followers, Meir Kahana and Gush Emunim, which is a Dati Lumi movement, very into settling the land, all of them had said that we should not give away any land, so to speak, for peace. Now, a bunch of Chabad activists in England, amongst them a fellow named Mr. Peter Combs, wrote to Rabbi Jacobowitz and protested and said that Chabad were not such great extremists. So in order to clarify his position, the Rebbe then sent a number of letters to Rabbi Jacobowitz. And the idea was that even though the Rebbe may have had the same ultimate active position, he might have believed that we should take the same actions and not give away any land, the Rebbe's ideological grounds for doing so were a little bit different than some of the other groups that Rabbi Jacobowitz had lumped Chabad's position with. So let's explore the letters. The first letter is addressed to Mr. Peter Combs, and the Rebbe writes this letter in English on the third night of Hanukkah in the year 5741, which would be 1980. The Rebbe writes to Mr. Peter Pinchas Combs, "Greeting and blessings. This is to acknowledge receipt of your letter and enclosure. I am reluctant on principle to involve a layman, however knowledgeable," and here the Rebbe is referring to Mr. Combs, "even if he possesses smicha, in a matter that is the subject of debate between rabbis. However, after you receive the detailed letter from Rabbi and request a clarification, I have no choice but to address myself to the issues at hand and reply, though necessarily not in depth. I must begin with a general but crucial point, namely that the arguments against my supposed stand are based on misinformation or on misconception of what my stand is. Indeed, I find it difficult to understand how this could have happened since I have repeatedly explained my positions, so I will recap it once again. Point 1. I am completely and unequivocally opposed to the surrender of any of the liberated areas currently under negotiation. Note, the Rebbe says these lands are liberated since they are Jewish homelands, such as Yehuda and Shomron, the Golan, etc., for the simple reason and only reason that surrendering any part of them would contravene a clear psak din, a clear ruling in Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, or Orech Chaim, section 329, paragraphs 6 and 7. I have repeatedly emphasized this psak din has nothing to do with the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael or with the days of Mashiach, with Geula, redemption, and similar considerations, but solely with the rule of pikuach nefesh, of saving Jewish lives. This is further emphasized by the fact that this psak din has its source in the Talmud on Erevin, page 45a, where the Gemara cites an illustration of a border town under the terms of this psak din, the city of Naharda in Babylon, present-day Iraq, clearly not in Eretz Israel. I have emphasized time and time again that it is a question of and should be judged purely on the basis of Pikuach Nefesh, not geography. Point 2. The said Pesach Din deals with a situation where Gentiles, and the Rebbe notes the term is Gentiles, not enemies, besiege a Jewish border town, ostensibly to obtain straw and hay, and then leave. But because of the possible danger, not only to the Jews of the town, but also to other cities, the Shulchan Aruch rules that upon receiving news of the Gentiles' preparations, The Jews must mobilize immediately and take up arms even on Shabbat in accordance with the rule that Pikuach Nefesh supersedes Shabbos. Point three. Should there be a question whether the risk does in fact create a situation of Pikuach Nefesh, then, as in the case of illness, where a medical authority is consulted, the authority to make a judgment is vested in the military experts. If military experts decide that there is a danger of Pikuach Nefesh, there could be no other overriding considerations, since Pikuach Nefesh overrides everything else. Should the military experts declare that while there is such a risk, yet it should be taken for some other reason, such as political considerations, goodwill of the Gentiles, this would clearly be contrary to the Pesach Din, for the Pesach Din requires that Pikuach Nefesh, not political expediency, should be the decisive factor. Now, in regard to the liberated areas, all military experts, Jewish and non-Jewish, agree that in the present situation, giving up any part of them would create serious security dangers. No one says that giving up any part of them would enhance the defensibility of the borders. But some military experts are prepared to take a chance in order not to antagonize Washington and or to improve the international image, etc. To follow this line would not only go against the clear Pesach Din, but would also ignore costly lessons of the past. One glaring case in point is the Yom Kippur War. Days and hours before the attack, there were urgent sessions of the government discussing the situation with the military. Military intelligence pointed to the unmistakable evidence that an Egyptian attack is imminent, and the military experts advised a preemptive strike that would save many lives and prevent an invasion. However, the politicians, with the acquiescence of some military experts, rejected this action on the ground that such a step or even general mobilization before the Egyptians actually crossed the border would mean being branded as the aggressor and would jeopardize relations with the USA. This decision was contrary to the Pesach Din of Shulchan Aruch, as pointed out above. The tragic results of the decision bore out the validity of the Shulchan Aruch position as if it were necessary, for many lives were needlessly sacrificed, and the situation came close to a total disaster. But for God's mercies, suffice it to mention that the then Prime Minister was Golda Meir, later admitted that all her life she would be haunted by that tragic decision. Prime Minister Golda Meir wrote in her biography, Golda Meir Chayai, on that Friday morning, the day before Yom Kippur War started, at a meeting discussing the situation in Israel, I had to listen to my heart and call for a mobilization of reserves. For me, this incident cannot fade away, and it will not be forgotten. I cannot be comforted no matter what others say, no matter what logical excuses that others try comforting me with. I know I had to do it, and this awful knowledge will accompany me for the rest of my life. I will never be the person I was before the Yom Kippur War. Point four. I know, of course, that there are rabbis who are of the opinion that in the present situation as they see it, it would be permissible from the viewpoint of the Shulchan Aruch to return areas of Eretz Yisrael. But it is also known on what information they base this view. One argument is that the present situation is not identical with the hypothetical case of Neredah cited in the Talmud, because Eretz Yisrael is not in a state of being besieged by Gentiles. A second argument is that the present surrendering of some areas would not endanger lives. That these arguments are based on misinformation is patently clear. The Arab neighbors are prepared militarily. What is more, they do demand these areas as theirs to keep, and openly declare that if not surrendered voluntarily, they will take them by force and eventually everything else. A rabbi who says that the said Pesach Din, the Shulchan Aruch, does not apply in the present situation is completely misinformed on what the situation actually is. Point five. A further example of how facts can be publicly distorted is in connection with the surrender of the oil wells in Sinai. Some warned at the time that it would be a terrible mistake to give them up, since oil, in this day and age, is an indispensable vital weapon. For without it, planes and tanks are put out of action as surely as if they had been knocked out. Nevertheless, there were rabbis that defended the surrender of the oil wells. Again, having received and accepted the information that the country has ample oil reserves that will last for months. When it was suggested to them to verify this information with anyone who has some idea about the physical limitations of storing oil to build up reserves, especially in a small country with limited storage space, the suggestion was ignored. Sure enough, before long, the government found it necessary to demand from the USA urgent oil deliveries because the reserves would only last a few days. Moreover, prominent members of the government publicly admitted that it was a serious mistake to surrender the oil wells. Be it also noted that since the surrender of the oil wells in Sinai, according to the government's figures, some $2.5 billion were paid by it to Egypt for oil from the very same wells that had been surrendered. not to mention the fact that having to buy oil also in the spot market, all at exorbitant prices. Parenthetically, it is known who supplied the rabbis with this information. When one of the rabbis was asked, after it had been all too obvious that their psak din was based on false information, why does he not come out and openly reverse his position? The answer was that if he admitted publicly that he had been misled by a prominent Jew with a beard and pious sidelocks who was active in Jewish affairs, it would create Yichel Hashem, a desecration of God's name. Queried further whether this consideration halachically overrides correcting a psak din affecting the Pekuach Nefesh of many Jews, there was no further response. Point 7. I was taken to task, and this also in full public view, for placing so much emphasis on the security of Eretz Yisrael, the argument being that what has protected the Jewish people during the long galus, during the long exile, has been the study of Torah and practice of mitzvos. Hence, Torah observant Jews should not make the inviolability of Eretz Yisrael as the overriding cause. I countered that they missed the point, for my position has nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael as such, but with the pikuach nefesh of the Jews living there, which would apply to any part of the world. I have not yet received an answer at this point either. Point 8. I was similarly criticized for accusing the government of Eretz Yisrael of reluctance to find and apprehend the perpetrators of the murderous attack in Hebron on that Friday night. And to note, this is an attack, I believe, on May 2nd, 1980, which was on a Friday night. There was a cell of Palestinian terrorists in Hebron killed a bunch of people who were coming back from the Aras Machpelah. Incidentally, one of the murderers who had been sentenced to life in prison but was then let out during a hostage deal is currently, as of 2024, the mayor of Hebron and has been the mayor of Hebron since 2017. I do not know what this has to do with the issue of returning liberated areas. At any rate, the facts are as follows. Before coming out to charge the government publicly with not trying to apprehend the murderers, I tried to do what I could behind the scenes. It is known there are two schools of thought in the government on this issue. One held that it would be expedient not to press the hunt for the killers on the ground that to find and put them on trial, etc., would exacerbate tensions. It would be better to put the matter at rest by procrastination. The other held that the government should take all possible actions to apprehend the killers and punish them swiftly. Not only because the blood of our brethren cries out to us from the earth, but also, just as importantly, for pikuach nefesh reasons, to prevent similar attacks. For anyone who knows the mentality of those Arab circles from which the territories came, knows that failure to punish them would be interpreted as a sign of weakness and encouragement to repeat such attacks. This debate went on for weeks. When I saw that inaction was the government's policy and that it would be a serious blow to pikuach nefesh, I made a public statement. Fortunately, it had an impact. And finally, the hunt began in earnest, resulting in the speedy apprehension of the leader of the gang. Parenthetically, the sad epilogue of this chapter, which is in itself a reflection of the state of affairs in Eretz Yisrael, is that although many weeks have passed since the murderer was caught, he has not yet been put on trial, and there is still no word to say as to when this will come to pass. No further commentary is necessary. It should be noted, however, that the policy of playing down terrorist attacks and avoiding counteraction whenever possible is unfortunately one that goes back many years, evidently for the reason indicated above, as it is also borne out by the enclosed newspaper clipping. Point 9. A further criticism leveled against me is that my pronouncement on the issues are more political than rabbinic. This too baffles me, for inasmuch as the matter has to do with pikuach nefesh, it is surely the duty of every Jew, be he rabbi or layman, to do all permitted by the Shulchan Aruch to help forestall or at any rate minimize the danger. In a case of pikuach nefesh, every possible effort must be made, even if there is a safek, even if there is a doubt, and many doubts, as to whether the effort will succeed. As to the matter regarding the reception given to the person involved in this controversy on his arrival to New York, as if I or my emissaries instigated a demonstration against him, etc., needless to say, this charge is totally not true. Even in an oral discussion, I am careful not to identify by name anyone who takes an opposing view, and limit myself to issues, not to personalities, especially when the person is known to me personally, and I have high regard for him, and from my side, still regard him as a friend. In conclusion, I must also say that in general, I find myself in an uncomfortable position in any situation where I find it necessary to disagree with an Orthodox rabbi publicly in a matter of halacha. For when a layman sees that there are rabbis who have been misled by misinformation, yet still that still do not retract the ruling even after the misinformation has been brought to light, it must necessarily affect his confidence in the credibility of rabbinic authority in general. Especially this, obviously, runs counter to the basic policy and the work of Lubavitch in disseminating Torah through Yiddishkeit with emphasis on the honor of the Torah and the honor of the true bearers of the Torah, the rabbis who dedicate all their life to the study of Torah and who live accordingly and exemplify Torah through Yiddishkeit to the fullest measure. Wishing you inspiring Hanukkah with esteem, the Rebbe's signature. In a postscript, the Rebbe adds, one point which I hesitated in embodying in my letter, but decided to add in this postscript is this. Rabbis who, differing from my view, declared their Torah and Halacha view on the question of returning liberated areas in Eretz Yisrael, also based it on the principle of the Kuach Nefesh, but in reverse to mine. Their opinion is based on the belief that returning liberated areas would advance the cause of peace with the Arabs and thus save lives. If this opinion is valid, it inexorably follows from it that the thrust of the argument as it is applied to the Golan, Yehuda, and Shimron applies also to the Old City of Jerusalem, and in fact more forcefully, since the clamor for the return of the Old Jerusalem is more genuinely unanimous and stronger by all Arabs, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the whole Islamic world, while not all of them are so enthusiastic about creating a new and independent Palestinian state on the West Bank. For the said rabbis to be consistent halachically, the return of Old Jerusalem is not only permissible but imperative. Hence, in all conscience, they are duty-bound to incorporate in their Psak Din the return of the Old City of Jerusalem. The Rebbe then summarizes in one page, point one. The subject matter of the controversy centers on a shaila and halacha, on a halachic question, namely pikuach nefesh. Therefore, the position of both the rabbis whose opinions differs from mine, as well as my position, must rest exclusively on the halacha and be treated purely as a halachic question. Number two, the question, the shaila, is not a theoretical one, but a practical one that is high on the actual agenda, namely whether from the halachic view it is permitted, mandatory, or forbidden to return liberated areas in the so-called West Bank and Gaza, as well as in the Sinai, including oil wells, military installations, etc. The psak din of this question must, of course, be based on the actual and factual circumstances of the situation as they affect the security of Eretz Yisrael and of our brethren living there. Point three. Both sides in the controversy, namely the rabbis who rule that it's halachically permissible to make territorial concessions, and those, myself included, who oppose this view, base their decision on the principle of pikuach nefesh, the difference being that the former concluded that territorial concessions would avert or minimize pikuach nefesh, while the latter hold that any territorial concessions would create or aggravate pikuach nefesh. Point four, there can be no difference of opinion among rabbis that in the case of pikuach nefesh, it is the duty of the rabbi not to remain silent and wait until approached to express his opinion. A rabbi who waits to be approached in such a situation is termed megunah, reproachable or blameworthy. Similarly, there can be no difference of opinion about the duty of every Jew without exception, through everything possible consistent with the Shulchan Aruch, to avert the danger of pikuach nefesh. The rabbi himself may not consider his duty done simply by pronouncing his psak din, but must take every possible action in this direction. Indeed, there are many precedents of Gedolei Yisrael actually doing things on Shabbos and Yom Kippur, which, but for the fact of pikuach nefesh, would be the most serious transgressions. Point five, since as noted, the sole deciding factor is pikuach nefesh, it is quite irrelevant what political orientation or party the rabbi issuing the psak din subscribes to, for his psak din must not be influenced in the slightest by anything except halacha alone. Point six, the evidence on which a rabbi or bezdin bases a psak din must strictly conform to the principle of don din emes l'amitai. That is to say, the judgment must be based on true facts and objective truth. If there is any doubt about the veracity of the presented evidence, it is the duty of the rabbi or bezdin to investigate and verify the facts and ascertain the real and complete truth. And upon discovery that the psak din was based on misrepresentation of the shaila, or of the facts submitted to them, they must, of course, promptly retract the erroneous psak din and rectify it.